se declara abierta la séptima sesión.
The seventh meeting of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, in accordance with our program of work, the Permanent Forum will take up item 5 of its agenda, half-day discussion.
Por favor, señores.
Please. In accordance with our program of work, the Permanent Forum will take up item 5 of its agenda, half-day discussion on North America. We shall now proceed with the panel discussion on North America. The panel will include representatives of the governments of the United States of America and of the Government of Canada, representatives of the Indigenous peoples of the United States and Canada, as well as a member of the Permanent Forum. The panelists will deliver introductory statements. Later, I will give the floor to the observers of member states, agencies, and Indigenous peoples organizations, as well as to non-governmental organizations. I would like to invite the panelists to join me on the podium. We invite Mr. Fred Caron of the Government of Canada. Mr. Caron. Ms. Kimberly Teehee, Government of the United States of America. Ms. Tonya Gonella Frichner, Permanent Forum Member. National Chief Sean Ainchut Atleo, representing the North American Caucus. Chief Oren Lyons, representing the North American Caucus.
Daremos la palabra.
I give the floor.
This is listo.
Daremos la palabra. Fred Caron.
Fred Caron? El primer orador.
The first speaker on my list is Mr. Fred Caron of the Government of Canada. You have the floor, Mr. Caron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we have a presentation today that we are going to be doing by PowerPoint. To start off, would like to express our thanks to you and the forum for inviting us here, and we look forward to this regional dialogue on North America. We hope that the format that we have chosen, which we have observed and taken lessons from previous presentations, will contribute to the evolution of this annual regional dialogue in a constructive manner. Mr. Chairman, the presentation consists of an overview of federal policy priorities and delivery mechanisms for Aboriginal peoples. And we are concentrating on the federal role, and there is much more, obviously, that is also done in this area by our provinces and territories. So in the interest of time, Mr. Chairman, we will give an overview. More detailed information on all of these items is available from our delegation and has been discussed in various side events, both at this forum and in previous forums. Notably in this forum, the Federal Framework for Aboriginal Economic Development as well as our approach to urban indigenous issues. Mr. Chairman, it's in the context of Canada, we have a very diverse Aboriginal population. First Nations, Métis, and Inuit come from very cultural, geographic, and economic backgrounds. And this is important in the case of Canada to take into account in developing our priorities and approaches to solutions to these issues. We put a premium in Canada on working with Aboriginal partners, and in doing so in a fashion which respects both their rights and the rights of other Canadians, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal alike. The next slide, Mr. Chairman, demonstrates the five pillars of our federal policy agenda, which you will see are economic development, education, empowering citizens and protecting the vulnerable, the resolution of land claims, and reconciliation, governance, and self-government. All these themes, Mr. Chairman, are meant towards producing and resulting in healthy and prosperous Aboriginal communities and individuals. The principles of culture and identity and development with culture and identity, which are the theme of this forum, are embedded in the Canadian policies which are designed to facilitate the political, social, and economic development of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. Examples of this include negotiation and implementation of such fundamental matters as land claims and self-government arrangements, and the control for economic development and social services, such as health care, education, and child and family services. Mr. Chair, the next slide gives a picture, a very simple picture, of the distribution of the Canadian Aboriginal population. The 2006 census in Canada identified 1.1 million Aboriginal people, which is close to 4% of the Canadian population. There are 615 First Nations, who together with the Métis and Inuit comprise more than 50 nations or cultural groups, 11 major linguistic families, and more than 50 Aboriginal languages. Nearly half of the registered Indian population lives on reserve. Over one-fifth of the total Aboriginal population live in seven large urban centres, mainly in Western Canada. Most Inuit live in Nunavut, the northwestern Northwest Territories, northern Quebec, and northern Labrador. Métis reside across Canada, with most in Western Canada, which is almost 70%, and 18% live within Ontario. And in 2006, Mr. Chairman, more than 50% of Aboriginal population lived in urban areas. And this is a growing phenomenon in Canada, and that is one of the reasons why we had our side event yesterday, which discussed urban Aboriginal issues. Mr. Chair, the next slide deals with the concept of community well-being. We have developed in Canada sophisticated tools for gathering and analyzing data to assist us in designing effective policy. For example, the Community Well-Being Index, which is a model which mirrors the United States the United Nations Human Development Index, helps us to understand conditions, trends, and gaps that must be addressed. This CWB index is derived from the Canadian Census of Population. And the factors which are taken into account in coming up with the graph that you see before you are education, which looks primarily at how many people, community members, have at least a high school education, and secondly, at how many have attained a university degree. Secondly, it looks at labor force activity in terms of how many community members participate in the labor force and how many labor force participants have jobs. Thirdly, income, which is calculated based on total income per capita. And fourthly, housing, which looks at the number of community members whose homes are in an adequate state of repair and are not overcrowded. As you can see, unfortunately, from the chart, Mr. Chairman, the well-being gap has not narrowed since 2001. So there is much work to do, and we're hoping that what you're going to see before you in the policy agenda that I will describe will work towards closing that gap. Sir Chairman, in terms of Canada's commitment, which you see on this slide that's before you now, you will see that we provide over $10 billion each year in programs through 34 federal departments and agencies. And this funding supports the five priorities that I spoke to you about. It is important to note, though, while there are specific programs and investment from Aboriginal people in Canada, all government programs are available to Aboriginal people as citizens of Canada. So the figures before you outline Aboriginal-specific expenditure and only federal expenditure. The other important factor, of course, is the programs and policies that are in force in our provinces and territories, which also apply to Aboriginal people. Mr. Chairman, the policy of the government of Canada and its actions are more than about just funding and investment. We are seeking to establish partnerships with key stakeholders and interested partners, such as our provincial and territorial governments and our Aboriginal organizations. Over the past year alone, efforts have been made to finalize a number of partnership and tripartite agreements with various provincial and territorial governments and First Nations, Inuit, and Métis organizations. And the bulk of the federal government's programs are delivered through partnerships or in conjunction with Aboriginal communities, provincial and territorial governments. Mr. Chair, in the speech from the throne that was delivered on March 3, 2010, the speech from the throne sets out the government's priorities. We have committed in Canada to make safe water and effective wastewater treatment on reserve a national priority, and have introduced and will introduce new legislative measures to further this goal. We have committed to protect the rights of Aboriginal people, particularly women living on reserve. We have taken steps and recently to introduce legislation which will protect the distribution of real property assets in the event of death, divorce, or separation for Aboriginal people. We have also introduced legislation to comply with a recent court decision to address gender equality, inequality rather, under the Indian Act. We will further take action to address the disturbing number of unsolved cases of murdered and missing Aboriginal women. The Sisters in Spirit initiative has drawn particular attention to this pressing criminal justice priority. And lastly, Mr. Chairman, we have committed in Canada to take steps to endorse the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. To deal with the first pillar, Mr. Chairman, of the agenda that I've described in terms of economic development, I mentioned previously that Aboriginal Canadians face unique economic challenges. Median income is 33% lower than the Canadian average, and the unemployment rate is more than double that of non-Aboriginal people. The federal framework for Aboriginal economic development, which was launched in June 2009, was developed to increase the participation of Aboriginal women and men in the Canadian economy. It represents the beginning of a change in how Government of Canada supports Aboriginal economic development and ensures that First Nations, Inuit, and Métis in Canada have every opportunity to share in Canada's economic opportunities and prosperities. And as I mentioned before, Mr. Chairman, we had a side event over the lunch break today which explained this framework in greater detail. We are now working with a broad range of Indigenous organizations to improve those economic development programs, including the National Aboriginal Economic Development Board. In recent months, we have launched important new initiatives with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis organizations and leaders to promote and collaboratively manage economic development opportunities for their populations. And lastly, the Urban Aboriginal Strategy has been renewed with a five-year investment of $68.5 million and is refocused on job training and entrepreneurship for Aboriginal people living in urban areas. Mr. Chairman, education is a key to success and prosperity in today's knowledge-based economy. In Canada and around the world, improved efforts are needed to raise the educational attainment of Indigenous people and to include Indigenous culture in education programs. The federal government remains committed to improving education outcomes for Aboriginal learners, and it cannot do it alone. Collaborative efforts are required to achieve better results, and the government is continuing to partner with Aboriginal communities and provincial and territorial governments to achieve lasting reform. In December 2008, the federal government launched the First Nations Student Success Program and the Education Partnerships Program. They have had significant participation from eligible community, and to date have invested $30 million in 65 proposals representing 84% of First Nations schools. In April 2009, the Inuit Education Accord was signed between the Inuit of Canada as represented by the Inuit Tipiriat Kanatami. And Budget 2010, which was recently adopted, provides $30 million over 2 years to support implementation-ready tripartite K-12 education agreements. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, in 2009 and 10, 93 school construction and renovation projects received funding. With increased opportunities for employment, the Government of Canada will continue to foster partnerships that help Aboriginal people get the education, skills, and training to take advantage of job prospects in Canada. The third pillar, Mr. Chair, refers to empowering First Nations citizens and protecting the vulnerable. And it is aimed at providing Aboriginal people with access to similar legal and human rights protection and core services such as other Canadians, and addressing quality of life issues in high-risk areas such as water, protection of women's rights, children and family services, improved housing and health programs. Canada's Economic Action Plan, released in 2009, committed $1.4 billion in investment over 2 years related to Aboriginal-specific programming in areas such as skills and training, health, child and family services, housing, educational facilities, and water and wastewater systems. In 2006, there were 193 high-risk First Nation water systems. Today, this number has been significantly reduced to 44 systems which are at risk. To tackle health gaps, over $2 billion annually is dedicated to First Nations and Inuit health in primary health care delivery, home and community care services, and culturally relevant health care delivery. These programs are community-driven, culturally relevant health promotion and disease prevention services to address the gaps in health which exist between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Canadians. The Government of Canada is implementing a new prevention approach to child welfare on reserve to keep First Nations families together and to reduce the need to bring children into care. We reached tripartite framework agreements in Quebec and Prince Edward Island, in addition to those already established in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Nova Scotia. We have, in terms of protecting rights of individual, additional legislation, which I referred to before, to remedy discriminatory provisions of the Indian Act. It is being done in consultation with First Nations to further protect the rights of Aboriginal people, particularly women living on reserve, and to ensure the equitable distribution of real property assets in the event of death, divorce, or separation. Mr. Chair, resolution of land claims is the fifth pillar of the agenda which I described. Land claims cover much of the territory of Canada, in addition to those which have already been settled by historic treaties which were signed early in Canada's history. These land claims agreements, which are often referred to as modern treaties, must be approved by the Indigenous community affected, as well as by the federal parliament and provincial legislatures. These agreements, Mr. Chair, receive protection under the Constitution of Canada. If you look at the map, which we will put up on the screen, to date we have 22 comprehensive claims or modern treaties, which involve 91 communities and that have been finalized, equal to an area of 4 million square kilometers, which is the combined size of Mexico, Colombia, and Venezuela. $2.2 billion in payments have been made to Indigenous groups. 17 self-government agreements have been concluded. And The claims agreements contain provisions which include impact benefit agreements with mining companies at various staging of the mining sequence and other measures which are designed to provide Aboriginal people with input into development. Mr. Chair, the pillar of the Canadian agenda relating to reconciliation, governance, and self-government contains a number of important elements which I will mention. Section 35 of our Constitution Act recognize and affirm the existing Aboriginal and treaty rights of the Aboriginal people of Canada. These Aboriginal rights are collective rights of distinctive Aboriginal societies flowing from their status as the original peoples. Treaty rights are rights conferred in both historic and modern treaties. Today, Mr. Chairman, most importantly, the lens for addressing Aboriginal and treaty rights is that of reconciliation. The Supreme Court of Canada has expressed this in many of its decisions, and the fundamental purpose of the constitutional recognition of existing Aboriginal and treaty rights in Section 35 involves reconciling the pre-existence of Aboriginal society with the sovereignty of the Crown and balancing the rights of interest of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Canadians. Reconciliation is not just a legal exercise. It is an ongoing process of establishing and maintaining a framework for living together in Canada. On June 11, 2008, our Prime Minister offered a formal apology to Aboriginal communities affected by the Indian residential school system in Canada. For more than a century, until the last school was shut down in the 1990s, this system separated more than 150,000 Aboriginal children from their home and communities. The settlement agreement provided for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and a compensation package of over $1.3 billion to 64,000 former students. By addressing this sad chapter in Canada's history, the government sent a clear signal that it is committed to build a new relationship between Aboriginal people and other Canadians. Mr. Chair, the Canadian Aboriginal agenda, as I mentioned, is based primarily on arriving at solution in partnership with our Aboriginal people. But it is also important that we are able to work with other governments, both to obtain the benefit of their experience and share with them the benefit of ours. And also to work on solutions together which may apply in both country, in either country. We are very pleased to have concluded on March 29, 2010, a memorandum of understanding which was signed between Canada and the United States, which was signed by our Minister Strahl and Secretary Salazar. This is based on the recognition that Canada and the United States share many areas of mutual interest and could benefit from sharing positive experiences and challenges. The Minister and Secretary Salazar affirmed that the intention is to help improve the quality of life for American Indians and Alaska Natives and Indigenous people throughout the United States and Canada. And as a result of the Memorandum of Understanding, a joint work plan will be developed between officials at Indian and Northern Affairs Canada and the Department of Interior. And it's important for me to note as well, which Grand Chief Atlio will speak about, the partnerships that exist between Aboriginal groups in Canada and the United States, and we hope that the partnership created between the two governments will complement and make more effective the partnership that exists between the Aboriginal peoples of our respective countries. Mr. Chairman, I will conclude by talking about, very briefly, if you will permit me, on the 2010 Winter Olympics. The Government of Canada was a proud partner in the 2010 Winter Games. It represented an opportunity to shine a light on Canada as an innovative, inclusive, and progressive nation. The four host First Nations and the Vancouver Organizing Committee for the 2010 Winter Games worked closely together to achieve unprecedented Aboriginal participation in those games. We would like to thank Tawani Joseph for giving us permission to use this video. Tawani wanted to make a couple of points in relation to this video, which I will share with you now before we run it. The four host First Nations message has been that they are not ignoring the social and economic problems that Aboriginal communities face by not including these issues in this video. Their interest was in showing a positive, modern side of their communities. They believe that their success through partnering with all levels of government and private groups can be seen as an example of how larger social issues can be addressed. And he also invited people to refer to his past public statements for more comments. Mr. Chairman, I would like to now present the video, and that will conclude my presentation. Thank you very much. Thank you, members of the Permanent Forum, honored delegates. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señor Caron.
Thank you very much, Mr. Caron. We appreciate the video and also the work that can be done among indigenous peoples, between indigenous peoples and states on a subject which is of interest to us all and which unites us, that is the question of sports. And we also appreciate what you've announced on Canada's position regarding the Declaration on Indigenous Peoples. It's a very important announcement. For me, as member of an Indigenous people of the South, and the same applies to our brothers and sisters from Asia and Africa, whatever is done in North America, and in this case in Canada, for example, through the announcement that you've made, about the kilometers in the hands of Indigenous peoples, I think this is a fine step toward the right to self-determination, and indigenous peoples will be able to work in the framework of self-determination on the development processes that we have discussed in order to restore our rights, as mentioned in past sessions by our brothers and sisters. We're going to give the floor now to our distinguished colleague, Ms. Tonya Gonilla Frichtner. You have the floor, madam.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. Mr. Chairperson, I'd like to give greetings to everyone in the room, all the distinguished delegates that are present here today. This is an important occasion for Indigenous nations and peoples to engage in dialogue with representatives from the governments of Canada and the United States of America. Today's topic is the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that was adopted by the UN General Assembly on the 13th of September, 2007. After over 30 years of tireless work by Indigenous peoples and their allies, the vote was 143 in favor, 11 abstentions, and 4 no votes. Since 2007, 2 abstainers, Samoa and the Government of Colombia, have decided to endorse or support the declaration, which we welcome. Also in 2009, Australia agreed to support the declaration, which we also welcome. Today, we are mindful of the fact that New Zealand has expressed its support for the declaration, which we also welcome. Additionally, U.S. Ambassador Rice has officially announced that the Obama administration will now begin a full review of the declaration and compare it to U.S. laws and policies. For its part, Canada has said it will now begin to take steps towards endorsing the declaration, which we also welcome. At the opening of this year's permanent forum, we were very gratified to hear UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's clear statement to Indigenous peoples, and I quote, "You have a unique place in the global community. You are a full and equal members of the United Nations family." This is a far cry from the days of the 1920s when Chief Tiscaje, representing the Haudenosaunee, traveled across the Atlantic Ocean to the League of Nations in Geneva in an effort to have human rights grievances addressed. He was not allowed to sit in the visitors' gallery and couldn't get an audience because of political pressures exerted against him. There was also a Maori delegation that traveled to the League of Nations at that time, with no success. UN Secretary General Ban Ki's statement in the context of the adoption of the UN Declaration provides a context within which to measure today's dialogue between Indigenous nations and peoples and the United States and Canada. Certainly today's dialogue is significant. However, let's hope this is the beginning of what will prove to be a much longer, detailed and fruitful dialogue with regard to the original and human rights of Indigenous peoples, both individual and collective rights, including the right to self-determination, collective rights to lands, territories and resources, the right to free, prior and informed consent, treaty rights, and the right to sovereignty. These and other rights are critically important to prevent further desecration and destruction of Indigenous peoples' sacred sites and significant places by development projects based on the Western worldview, projects such as ecologically destructive mining and other extractive industries on the lands and territories of Indigenous nations and peoples. As we look back, we see that ever since our brothers from Europe first came to the shores of Turtle Island from Europe, there has been such dialogue and much dialogue between Indigenous nations and the British Crown and between Indigenous nations and the United States and Canada. Our treaties are evidence of recognition by the British Crown, Canada, and the United States of the original territorial and political rights of the original sovereigns of Turtle Island, now called North America. Given our treaties affirming Indian nationhood, why did North American and Indian leaders and indigenous nations and peoples find it necessary to enter the United Nations arena in the 1970s? Simply stated, it was because they found no effective means of addressing their grievances within domestic law systems. Domestic law in the United States and Canada, for example, is premised on the use of the doctrine of discovery and its concomitant framework of dominance. This domestic, indeed dominating, doctrinal framework is used to claim a superior right to our lands, our territories, and our resources, despite the treaties and international standing of indigenous nations and peoples. A preliminary study of the doctrine of discovery was recently presented to the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum. The preliminary study identifies how the doctrine of discovery has been used in domestic law against our nations and peoples, in violation of our original sacred birthrights and our fundamental human rights, including our right of and to self-determination and our rights to our lands, our territories, and our resources. The premise of the doctrine of discovery was expressed in 1823 by then Chief Justice John Marshall in the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Johnson versus McIntosh. In that decision, the Supreme Court pointed to the Royal Charters of England and said, on the basis of discovery by Christian people of lands inhabited by natives who were heathens, the Christian Europeans claimed the ultimate dominion to be in themselves. Both the United States and Canada used the Johnson decision and its Christian religious categories as foundational to their legal and political system, and as a basis for claiming a superior dominion over our indigenous nations and over our lands and territories. Those religious categories are now a foundational feature of what is called domestic law and policy. For us, domestic law and policy means dominating law and policy. Let us be clear. The human rights abuses we are contesting in the international arena do have a cause. That cause has a long history, extending back to the very symbolic acts and assertions of sovereignty by the invading powers in their efforts to claim for themselves, on the basis of papal decrees and royal charters, the lands and resources and territories of indigenous nations and peoples. An official position shared by Canada and the United States is that they will deal with indigenous nations and peoples only by means of domesticating language and domestic law and policy. However, it is illogical to suggest that the very same language, laws, and policies that serve as the root cause of the human rights violations of indigenous peoples will also be the means of ending those violations. To say that the framework violates human rights is also the means of ending those violations is not a coherent position, we believe, for the United States and Canada to take. We cannot pretend that the very same domestic laws and policies that drove indigenous nations and peoples into the international arena in 1923 and 1977 will magically serve as the means of redressing and ending those human rights violations. Full endorsement, support, and implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which is a reaffirmation of Indigenous peoples' fundamental human rights, is a critically important and necessary step toward ending those human rights violations. Donato, I am finished.
Muchas gracias, señora.
Thank you, Ms. Gunilla Frischner. Moving along with our list of speakers, we give the floor to Ms. Kimberly Teehee of the Government of the United States of America to take the floor. You have the floor.
Good afternoon. I am honored to be with you today. I want to begin by thanking the members of the Permanent Forum and representatives of the Indigenous peoples, many of whom have traveled great distances to participate in this event. Your commitment to address the many important issues that Indigenous peoples face around the world is remarkable. At the outset of my remarks, I want to acknowledge that the United States has a unique legal and political relationship with 564 federally recognized Indian tribes established through and confirmed by the Constitution of the United States, treaties, statutes, executive orders, and judicial decisions. President Obama is committed to strengthening and building on the government-to-government relationship between the United States and the Indian tribes. Tribal communities have contributed greatly to America's cultural, social, and political traditions. Throughout our land, we have a diversity of indigenous cultures with rich religious traditions. Native religious practices and their expression through song and dance endure and flourish despite wayward attempts to extinguish them during less enlightened times. Tribal culture practices add to the fabric of the United States. From the American Revolution to military missions in Iraq and Afghanistan, Native people have served valiantly in the armed forces of the United States. Many brave Native men and women have made the ultimate sacrifice, fighting and shedding blood for this country. In so many ways, the first Americans have added to the wealth and betterment of the United States and the American people. Despite the contributions they have made, we have not always responded in kind. All too often, federal policies undermined the ability of Indian tribes to build strong, self-sufficient, and self-governing tribal communities. When the United States adopted misguided policies, the first Americans suffered greatly. The history of our first Americans is a history that we must acknowledge to avoid repeating our mistakes. The Native people once owned this continent, and they were often dispossessed of their lands by threat of war or unbridled encroachment in the name of westward expansion. When Native people stood in the way, they were often forcefully removed. Many Americans have heard of the brutality of the Cherokee removal called the Trail of Tears. But the Cherokees were not alone, as vast communities throughout the East from New York to Florida were moved at the tip of the bayonet, their homelands forever taken. When their tribal lands were dramatically diminished, the United States adopted a policy aimed to acculturate American Indians by breaking up their remaining tribal lands into individual allotments. There were other misguided attempts at forced assimilation, outlawing of Native religions, as well as dance and song, taking of children and forcing them into boarding schools, which banished their language, dress, and ways of their people. The federal policy of termination was designed to end the political existence of tribal governments. In this history, there are important lessons and guidance from destructive policies that sunk tribal communities deeper into the cycle of poverty and despair. Experience also shows us the type of policies that build the foundation for tribal communities to flourish culturally, socially, and economically. Our most recent history demonstrates tribal self-determination, the ability of tribal governments to determine how to build and sustain their own communities is necessary for successful and prospering communities. The federal policy of tribal self-determination is guided by the deep and abiding belief that tribal governments are in the best position to decide the direction of their future. More than 40 years since the United States adopted this policy of greater tribal autonomy, the record is clear. Tribal self-determination has been successful. It has enabled tribal governments to establish, develop, and enhance tribal institutions and infrastructure, ranging from those addressing the health, education, and welfare of their communities to those such as tribal courts, fire protection, and law enforcement, which have allowed them to better protect their communities. The clear lesson is that empowering tribes to deal with the challenges they face and take advantage of the available opportunities will result in tribal communities that thrive. Despite the success of this policy, the devastating consequence of the past still haunts us. Tribal communities still suffer from among the most challenging socioeconomic conditions. Some reservations face unemployment rates of up to 80%. Nearly a quarter of all Native Americans live in poverty. Approximately 14% of homes on reservations don't have electricity, and 12% don't have access to safe water supply. Poverty often breeds crime. Native communities are faced with an increase of youth gangs engaged in drug trade. Some tribes have experienced rates of violent crime twice, four times, and at times more than 10 times the national average. Most tragically is the fact that one in three Native women will be raped in their lifetimes, which President Obama called this an assault on our national conscience that we can no longer ignore when he addressed the tribal leaders at the White House Tribal Nations Conference last year. Perhaps the greatest victims of poverty and violent crime on reservations are the children. Native Americans face some of the lowest matriculation rates and the highest high school and college dropout rates. In addition, Native Americans face disproportionate health disparities compared to the general population. Native Americans die of illnesses like tuberculosis, alcoholism, diabetes, pneumonia, and influenza at far higher rates than the rest of the population. Though our challenges are difficult, our future is far from bleak. President Obama believes that tribal leaders must be part of the solution if we are going to address the needs of Native Americans. We must begin a new era in the United States' relationship with tribal governments, one that is built on mutual respect. By working together on a government-to-government basis, we can realize a future where Native people live long and healthy lives in safe communities, are able to pursue economic self-sufficiency, and where their children and grandchildren can have an equal opportunity at pursuing the American dream. To address the myriad challenges facing tribal communities, we have taken a number of steps to strengthen the government-to-government relationship between the United States and Indian tribes. First, President Obama promised greater engagement with tribal leaders. In November, President Obama invited representatives from each of the 564 federally recognized Indian tribes to attend a White House Tribal Nations Conference. Nearly 400 tribal leaders attended, making it the most widely attended interactive White House tribal meeting with the president, cabinet secretaries, senior officials, and members of Congress in history. The White House held listening sessions with tribal leaders and representatives from tribal organizations on health care, energy development, tribal consultation, job creation, and education. The level of engagement with tribal leaders is extraordinary and continues outside of Washington, D.C. Our federal agencies are engaged in unprecedented outreach to tribal communities. Second, President Obama believes that Native Americans need representation in the federal government to properly reflect their needs and views. History has shown that failure to include voices of tribal officials in formulating policy affecting their communities has all too often led to undesirable and, at times, devastating tragic results. To ensure that Native Americans are represented in this administration, President Obama has appointed Larry Echohawk of the Pawnee Nation as the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, Dr. Yvette Rubidoux of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe as Director of our Indian Health Service, Hillary Tompkins of the Navajo Nation as the Solicitor of the Department of Interior, Lillian Sparks of the Rosebud and Oglala Sioux Tribes as Commissioner of our Administration for Native Americans, Mary McNeil of the Winnebago Tribe as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights for the United States Department of Agriculture, Jody Gillette of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe as Deputy Associate Director of the White House Office of Intergovernmental Affairs. Working with tribal leaders, this team is helping shape federal policies that impact tribal communities. Third, President Obama is committed to regular and meaningful consultation with tribal leaders. Marking a new era in the United States' relationship with tribal governments, the President signed a memorandum on November 5, 2009, directing every federal agency to develop a plan to fully implement the Executive Order 13175, called Consultation and Coordination with Tribal Governments. This order mandates that all agencies have an accountable process for meaningful and timely input by tribal officials in the development of regulatory policies that have tribal implications. The federal agencies are implementing consultation plans, and the level of tribal consultation is at historic levels. Fourth, President Obama recognizes that a comprehensive response to address the needs of tribal communities means federal agencies must work together. Federal agencies across various agencies are working together on a wide range of issues to improve the lives of Native Americans. This combination of greater engagement, greater representation, greater consultation, and interagency collaboration is the foundation upon which we will help build stronger tribal communities and enable the United States' relationship with Indian tribes to flourish. Following these guidelines will enable the United States and tribal leaders to work together and build a brighter future for tribal communities. Indeed, it is the only way to establish the proper foundation to address the many issues that have vexed our relationship for decade after decade, impacting generation after generation of Native peoples. We have serious work ahead, and we are making progress. This administration is addressing the many challenges facing tribal communities by addressing funding needs. Last year, in the face of an economic crisis, President Obama took immediate action to help all Americans by signing the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act to spur economic activity and to create new jobs. The law allocates more than $3 billion to help tribal communities. These funds are being used to renovate schools on reservations across the country, spur job creation in tribal economies, improve housing and energy efficiency, and support health facilities and policing services. In addition, President Obama's fiscal year 2011 budget request proposes $18.482 billion, a 5% increase over the fiscal year 2010 budget, in total federal funding for Native American programs. This funding will help to increase educational opportunities, promote economic development, support lending in low-income communities, combat crime in tribal communities, and increase access to health care. While funding increases do not make up for our past failures, they do reflect President Obama's commitment to honor the United States government-to-government relationship with Indian tribes. If we're going to bring about real change to tribal communities, we must develop a comprehensive approach for Native Americans. Last month, President Obama signed a law, the Affordable Care Act, which includes important provisions for Native Americans who continue to face gaping health disparities. Signing this law is a major step in fulfilling our responsibility to provide health care to American Indians and Alaska Natives. President Obama recognizes that education is essential to ensuring a viable and prosperous future for tribal communities. The Affordable Care Act provides significant federal funding to support tribal colleges and institutions serving Native Americans, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. President Obama acknowledges that Native Americans are struggling to preserve their languages. He supports greater flexibility in the use of education funds to meet the needs of Native students, including allowing funding for Native language immersion and Native language restoration programs. Improving public safety in tribal communities is a top priority for the administration. President Obama supports federal legislation, the Tribal Law and Order Act, to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of the tribal justice systems and better prevent crime in tribal communities. In addition, the President supports initiatives to hire new Indian Country Assistant United States attorneys to prosecute cases involving violent crime on Native lands and provide additional federal agents to support law enforcement efforts in tribal communities. Addressing crimes involving violence against women and children on Native lands is a particular priority for the administration. In December, the administration announced that it reached a settlement agreement with plaintiffs in the Cobell v. Salazar case, one of the largest class action lawsuits ever brought against the United States. The agreement, which requires legislative and judicial approval to become effective, settles claims regarding the federal government's management of trust accounts maintained by the United States of more than 300,000 individual Indians. Pending for more than 13 years, this protracted litigation cast a shadow over the United States' relationship with Indian tribes and with individual Indians. This agreement lays the foundation for reconciliation between individual Indian account holders and the federal government and for more effective management of Indian trust assets for future generations. Renewable energy development is one of the President's highest priorities, and the United States has come far in development of renewable resources under the President's leadership. New jobs are being created, and many more are coming in the clean energy sector. We are working closely with tribes to assist them with the exploration and development of tribal lands with active and potential energy resources. To achieve this result, we are finding creative solutions that will bring affordable, clean energy to Indian country. In addition, we are moving administrative barriers that hinder renewable energy development by streamlining and expediting the permit process for energy development and transmission across tribal lands. As we engage tribal leaders about the solutions to address unemployment on Indian lands, we know for certain that we need many approaches. Each tribe is unique, and tribal voices must be heard if we are to create jobs in tribal communities. Tribal leaders say that entrepreneurship is a key to successful economic development in tribal communities. Federal agencies are assisting tribes to improve infrastructure that will foster business creation, educate youth in entrepreneurship and financial literacy, and provide other technical assistance to business owners. President Obama supports efforts to increase access to information technology in underserved areas. Many tribal businesses are located in geographically remote locations and are hard-pressed to succeed without access to high-speed broadband internet use. In order to ensure that tribal businesses are able to compete on a global playing field, tribal communities must have greater access to broadband. Through investment in infrastructure, green technology, information technology, and education, President Obama has gone beyond talk and made possible a new and better future for tribal communities. Climate change adaptation is a priority for President Obama, and tribal communities are on the front line of this challenge. In an era where the challenge of climate change confronts the world, the original stewards of this continent can teach us essential lessons regarding proper and effective stewardship. Tribal communities have long considered the impact of their actions on generations ahead, a philosophy grounded in responsibility and setting the necessary antecedent foundation for sustainability. Combating climate change is particularly crucial for Alaska Native communities, which are among the first communities in the United States to experience its devastating impact. During the White House Tribal Nations Conference, tribal leaders recommended that President Obama re-examine our position regarding the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We welcomed the dialogue with tribal officials. Ambassador Rice said this week that this is an important recommendation that directly complements our commitment to work together with the international community on many challenges that Indigenous peoples face. The United States will undertake a formal review of the declaration, and we will engage in consultation with Indian tribes and seek input from interested non-governmental organizations. We are moving in the right direction, but our work is not done. Improving health care and addressing health disparities, providing a sound education for Indian children, ensuring that Native people will enjoy a safe community free from the impending peril of violent crime, and setting a foundation for a sound and sustainable economic development, these and so many others are our objectives. On behalf of President Obama, I thank you again for your commitment to tackle the many issues facing Indigenous peoples. Our commitment to greater engagement, greater representation, greater consultation, and interagency collaboration is the foundation upon which we will build stronger tribal communities and enable the United States' historic government-to-government relationship with Indian tribes to flourish. Thank you.
Señora, muchas gracias por sus...
Thank you very much for the announcements you've made. Also, for recognizing the suffering of all Indigenous peoples as a result of the colonization of our lands. Next on the list of speakers, we'll give the floor to Chief Orrin Lyons. You have the floor, Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Congratulations on your new position, and I wish you very, very good health and great achievement during your tenure. Also, I want to extend my greetings to all the people who are attending here and the people who have worked so hard for so many years and continue to aspire to a better life. And the work that the indigenous people have accomplished over these past years. I want to thank you for all of that, and I want to thank both the United States and Canada for engaging today in a dialogue and a discussion. And amazingly different from past life here at the United Nations, and very good. The subject matter today is in a dialogue of what is most important, and for indigenous peoples and nations, land is the issue. Land has always been the issue, and the jurisdiction thereon. That is fundamentally the arena that we live in on a day-to-day basis, and it is the arena that we need to approach on a better, more even playing field, as they say. And what I've heard today, it sounds like there's going to be efforts in that direction. Over the past years of the engagement here of indigenous people at the United Nations, starting from, as my colleague Ms. Tanya Ganella Frischner mentioned, the Cayuga chief, Discahe, in 1923, coming here in an attempt to, well, it was a League of Nations then, but an attempt to address the World Forum on the issues of human rights and violations, fundamental violations. That was 1923, and then 1977, of course, now historic, the movement by indigenous people to Geneva. And consequently, over those years, the development of a process for discussion and meeting these challenges. And it was stated quite clearly that the reason why we were in Geneva and why we made that now historic journey was because there was little or no justice in the courts wherever we lived, indigenous people in North America, Central America, South America, and also in Northern Europe. The Sami people were there initially as well. And since that time, and I would remind everybody that it was the initiative of a group of people initially started by George Manuel on the definition of how shall we address ourselves when we come to this international forum. And we covered a whole gamut of what will it be, and we settled finally on indigenous. And that was our definition. And when we traveled to Geneva in 1977, indigenous peoples and nations were not on any radar screen. Indeed, there wasn't radar at the time. And so, from that time, progress, there has been tremendous progress. In 1971, in 73, when there was a battle going on in Wounded Knee, South Dakota, we were attempting to meet somebody in the United Nations, and we couldn't cross the street. There was a phalanx of police on right straight across the street. We couldn't get across the street to address anyone. That was 1973. Well, now here we are. And you have to admit that is quite a change. I mean, here we are addressing you from the General Assembly and in discussion and in consultation with states. So, yes, there has been progress, obviously, at the expense, of course, of a lot of people and lives and efforts. And I'm pleased with the movement and the development and the direction things are going. Certainly, we have a long ways to go. In that initial history, when we first went to Geneva, we persevered and we went again the next year and the next year. And finally, in 1982, they decided that they would have to deal with us. And so it became the Working Group for Indigenous Populations. And I want to make a point here. And the point here is that it was the Working Group for Indigenous Populations and not peoples. And that refers to a colleague, Ms. Tanya Ganella Frischner's reference to the doctrine of discovery. We were not peoples. And as we struggled through those years of 1980s and 90s, we were up against this kind of an invisible wall of why are we not part of the human rights of the rest of the world? How could we not be? And now we find out, yes, there is a reason for that, and it's quite clear. And so from that point on, we persevered, of course, and then developed our own declaration on our own rights, which we had to do over a period of time. And I must say that states that were involved in it, it was a very, very difficult and trying time for everybody, but certain people come forward, like Madame Dias, who just struggled with us and worked with us, and we had support, you know. And Miguel Alfonso Martinez, you know, he struggled and worked with our treaties, and we did the treaty study. All of that is in the development of a relationship and also the understanding of a people's right to be. And that is a fundamental to the whole discussion, the people's right to be. Fortunately, on the part of indigenous nations and people around the world, they did not succumb completely to the efforts to destroy culture, language, religions, ways of life. They did not. We still maintain ceremonies. We still do our work as best as we can. And now the business of repair is upon us. How do you repair damage done to children over the years and the destruction policies of destroying cultures? And as was said, you know, the first boarding school was Carlisle University, they called it. Carlisle School for Indians in Pennsylvania. And the watchword was kill the Indian and save the man. Kill the Indian and save the man. In other words, destroy the culture, destroy the language, destroy the very strength that they were admiring. And the attempts went on. And of course now we are hearing the results of that with the boarding schools in Canada and across the United States. But all of that is part of the history of our struggle for justice and simply to be recognized as peoples. Over these years of struggle and perseverance, that's enormous. Perseverance by people who have continued to work and continue to suffer without support, mind you, by ourselves, the best way we can, have now accomplished the most amazing thing, which was the adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And on that day, September 13th, 2007, we became peoples officially. Prior to that, as we note here that this is the permanent forum for indigenous issues, not peoples, or the working group for indigenous populations, not peoples, well, now here we are, recognized internationally and, as I said, by the chairman of this very, very great affair. He says, yes, we are part of the human family. All right. We knew that all along, but everybody else didn't seem to. So then we come to the discussion, you know, of what do we do about this? And what has happened in this long, these hours and years of trials and tribulations of indigenous people, which, of course, always translates to extraction, the ideas of how do we how are we relieved of our resources, our lands, our waters, the minerals, and all of that. It's been a discussion of extraction from the beginning. And so the idea that we come forward with now is how do we safeguard what is left? How do we defend what is left? And I'm interested to the question arises in my mind that this memorandum of understanding between Canada and the United States, which I'm glad they have, but where were the Indians? I mean, since the subject matter was us, and I'm sure we'll find out. And so, you know, as we move on, and we've heard very clearly from all of the speakers here, they've enunciated the problems they know about education and the health. Of course, we who live there experience all that. We don't have to be told that. We know exactly what it is and how difficult it is. However, I think at this particular juncture in human history, we're coming to a point where this discussion on jurisdictions and controls and power and authority have to be kind of put aside now for this idea that we're going to be this human crisis, and I state that clearly, crisis of life on this earth as we know it now, and it's global warming. And global warming is what is going to break economies. It's going to destroy economies. You're just not going to be able to keep up with it. And we had just a good example of that a few days ago with the volcano. And, it was 5 days, and we had airline shut down. And that's just the beginning. The waters are rising. I heard the president of Marshall Islands saying that he has 200,000 people who are already displaced and nobody wants them and no place to go. Well, these are the issues that we're going to be facing collectively as human beings. You know, a long time ago, when the Haudenosaunee Confederacy came about and the peacemaker made this great confederation we had, when he raised the leaders and he talked about democracy and the rights of women, placed the women in authority, responsibility, in our governing structure, clan mothers, who are the ones that choose the leaders. And I'd like to see that, too, here. I mean, that'd be great if the women were choosing the leaders. Because we do need the balance, and we are talking about that here. That's the discussion that's going on right now, and I'm pleased with that, of course. But the whole point here is that we are, you know, facing a crisis that is going to have is collective in nature, and we're going to have to work together. And the philosophy that's driving, and the best philosophy for dealing with this, is the long-range philosophy of indigenous peoples. Peoples who have look ahead and are in defense of the future and in defense of the lands and in defense of the life that's on it. And when I say that, I'm including trees and fish and deer. They need defense. They need as much defense as anyone. And that's our responsibility. And so I would say that progress indeed, yes, we are making progress, and President Obama has, well, it was extraordinary. Yesterday we were there talking with a team of 10 people, and what were they? 8 of them were Indians. Well, how about that? You know, I mean, that's... But I warned them that since they were going to be out front, they're going to have a lot of arrows in their backs and in front of them and so forth, because they're going to take the brunt of what was been going on for the past 200 years. So you had to be prepared for that. But nevertheless, that's the way it is. And I do think that this effort that we're making collectively here and the development of it, I think is a very good direction. And it's going to be up to us to see that it works. And it's going to take a lot of personal discipline to look out for the best interests of all. And with that, I'll close my remarks and thank you all for maintaining it and bringing it to this point, especially my Indian friends. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, Jefe Lyons.
Thank you very much, Chief Lyons, for your comments, your teachings, and your reflections. You've told us that if we've managed to come along such a thorny path and we've managed to persist, and here we are in the United Nations talking with states, it's really a great advance toward the recognition of our rights that it is true have not been recognized for so long. I'm going to give the floor now to National Chief Sean A. Inchut Atleo, representing the North American Caucus. Chief, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few words in my language. Chu Utlasisha Inchut Istakshit Lahosat. I am Ayanchut, or Sean Atleo, coming from the Ahouset First Nation, west coast of Vancouver Island, part of the Nuchonalth peoples. In my language, just as I'm always instructed, to walk lightly when outside your home territories. Acknowledge that there's another authority wherever it is that you're traveling, and I do so. Acknowledge the indigenous peoples of these lands. It's an honor to be here, Mr. Chairman, and in particular to follow the words, the nourishing words of Chief Lyons. So much appreciate your reflection on where it is that we've come from. And I know that I'm not the only, perhaps, younger person in the assembly here today who benefits greatly from understanding where we have come from in order to appreciate the moment that has arrived so that we can take the most that the opportunity affords. And so I am greatly honored to reflect back on the thoughts of the North American Indigenous Caucus. And they had met not so long ago in Alexis Nakota Sioux Nation territories and offered up the continuation of thoughts that Chief Lyons rightly recognizes the efforts of many of you who are here in attendance. I share a deep sense of appreciation for that work, and of course the ancestors who've gone on before us. I think about my late grandmother, passed on not so long ago. She would have been 88 years old. And when I was listening to Mr. Caron's presentation, I was thinking about the apology made by Canada in the summer of 2008. We were holding hands as she listened to the Prime Minister apologize, really, to her and to the residential school generation, the survivors. And she offered up some thoughts, but I remember her saying, "They're beginning to see us, grandson. They're beginning to see us," is what she said. She comes from a generation, of course, residential school survivors, wanted to become a nurse, but unable by law to go past grade 8 in school, unable to pursue her dreams. I carry her thoughts and her words in my heart when I am here today, and particularly as I listen to Chief Lyons, that the theme or the conversation about the Declaration, I particularly looked to Articles 3 about our right to freely determine our political status, our right to self-determination. Article 32, our right to determine and develop priorities and strategies. And as I was listening to Chief Lyons reflecting that the moment has arrived as Indigenous peoples, recognition as peoples that we would truly carry out our work together in that spirit. And that's what my late grandmother left me with. She said she had a great vision of being unable to turn a heavy page. And she said, "Grandson, the only way we're going to be able to do this is by doing this together," as Chief Lyons has said. Turn a heavy page on a dark chapter in our history and begin writing a new chapter together. And so, Mr. Chair, I just want to quickly cover three areas. First, to talk a little bit about the Canadian context, as we've heard somewhat described earlier. There was a speech in the speech from the throne March 3rd, most recently, an indication by the Canadian government that they would take steps to endorse the Declaration. And I'm reminded by the apology, the moment when my grandmother heard the Prime Minister's words, that they were made in a very manner in which she received as unqualified. It was an apology. It was a statement of what happened, where the Prime Minister said it was wrong, it should have never happened, and it must never happen again. And the emotions that she experienced were in that manner, that it was not offered up with qualifications, that it was simply a statement of what was wrong and that it should never happen again. And, of course, the work must commence. It must continue to see the full spirit and effect of that apology to be implemented and embraced. And in a similar fashion here, that we receive the federal government of Canada's signal as a movement away from opposition, as Chief Lyons has rightly reminded all of us of the progress that's being made. And hearing the Indigenous peoples of Canada, those that I and other leaders have a responsibility to serve, have also firmly stated to the Prime Minister that effective and unqualified endorsement by Canada is an urgent requirement and must lead to implementation that is done jointly. That this is something that, as Chief Lyons has said, and I would strongly support that notion, that we must do this together. It is what the ancestors, after all, what they laid out as a vision when the first treaties were forged. As in the Declaration, it's a standard of achievement to be pursued in a spirit of mutual respect and partnership between Indigenous peoples and states. One of the big areas that it speaks to in Article 3 is the right to determine citizenship. Indigenous peoples, as it says, have the right to self-determination, and such includes the right to determine citizenship. In Canada, the Indian Act and subsequent amendments to the Indian Act to address discrimination nonetheless continue to violate Indigenous inherent treaty and Aboriginal rights with regard to citizenship. Under the process of mutual respect and partnership, we have a requirement to focus not on Indian status, but rather on citizenship aimed at complying with the inherent treaty and Aboriginal rights of Indigenous nations to determine citizenship, and recognizing the deep division that has occurred over the course of history, whether it's taking a child to send off to a residential school or having the federal government decide on their own who is or isn't a status under the Indian Act. These have been great tools of division and have caused great turmoil to our people, and have also suggested that other areas that have been greatly divisive, whether it's your on or off reserve, the status of a reserve being that of a tool of the Indian Act, being again creating great division, or on and off settlement land. So I wanted to touch on citizenship because it has to do with our people and the connection with nations and the rebuilding of our nations, the repairing, as Chief Lyons suggested. To touch on land rights under which the federal government describes as comprehensive claims, one of the policies that that they work within. Indigenous peoples of Canada state that Canada must revise its comprehensive claims policy and abandon its policy of de facto extinguishment of Aboriginal title and rights. Canada must adopt an approach that is based on the recognition of inherent Indigenous land rights that is consistent with the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And this is what I have heard Chief Lyons referring to here, that in a process of mutual respect and partnership, that perhaps a broad joint parliamentary review is required within Canada to substantially revise current policy and practice. The rights holders, the community members, must be involved and challenged to determine their relationship with the land and the resources. It is, as the chief said, it is, after all, about land. In terms of other issues, when I, as was mentioned by Mr. Karan, as I was spending time with tribal leaders in the United States, reflecting on that notion that the borders were not created by us, that those are additional forms of divisions that have crept into the relationship between and amongst us as Indigenous nations and Indigenous peoples. Speaking to Indigenous leaders that are throughout the United States, the issue of water is raised, and we reflect that through ceremony and as expressed through treaty, Aboriginal title and rights, Indigenous peoples have indeed a very sacred relationship with all waters. And Chief Lyons referenced this issue of the impacts on the environment. Treaty Aboriginal and title rights and the right of self-determination is expressed in the Declaration includes the right as decision maker over matters impacting all aspects of water preservation, quality, access, and development. The UN process of the development of a water declaration must include the full involvement of the Indigenous peoples globally. The current legal framework within Canada denies this fundamental right to water and limits decision-making of Indigenous peoples. Current legislative efforts, and we've been raising this with the federal government, regarding safe drinking water within First Nations territories must respect and implement First Nation rights to water as opposed to current approach, which will further erode First Nations rights by the incorporation of provincial regulation regimes. Something very, very close to all of our people's heart. Cha'ak in my language would always be reminded by my late grandfather. Have your first drink when you first wake in the morning. Give thanks for life, to always be reminded about our relationship with the water and the environment around us. Speaking of the relationship, I have relatives that are just across the United States border in northern Washington state. Those are our people. We are their people. The same language. We think about the issue of the border. Looking at Article 36, Indigenous peoples, in particular those divided by international borders, have the right to maintain and develop contacts, relations, and cooperation, including activities for spiritual, cultural, political, economic, and social purposes. We're family. We are the same peoples, the same nations. And so those are including the provincial and territorial boundaries within the nation state of Canada have further imposed external divisions on us. We look at the Jay Treaty of 1794, recognizing the right of Indigenous peoples to unrestricted passage over the borders, including the movement of goods. And so in the process of mutual respect and partnership, that we establish processes that involve Indigenous peoples in Canada and the U.S., and the governments of Canada and the U.S. to confirm the Jay Treaty and to ensure that no passport or new status card requirements be imposed on Indigenous peoples from North America to cross the Canada-U.S. border, to not artificially divide our peoples and deprive them of traditional trade and economic relationships. And we look to our Indigenous brothers and sisters, Indigenous nations, that it will be our ongoing relationships that we will find strength and the resolve to address these issues. Touching on the MOU very briefly that's been talked about, it declares that the participants intend to encourage and facilitate direct contacts between tribal and Aboriginal governments, regional, territorial, and local governments. Indigenous peoples, as has already been said, must be included in the development of a joint work plan. And so therein perhaps lies an opportunity for us to explore, as Chief Lyons has said. Mr. Chair, I want to just quickly highlight the important ongoing role of the permanent forum and raise the notion about the international attention that's required in relation to alarmingly high rate of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls and high rates of violence against Indigenous women and girls. The Native Women's Association of Canada has confirmed there are more than 580 missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls in Canada. Action is needed now, including addressing the root causes of violence, meeting basic health, housing, food security, education, and employment needs of Indigenous women. Reforms to the justice system, including improved police services, culturally sensitive justice system, and alternative dispute mechanisms. Ensuring Indigenous children do not continue to be institutionalized through the child welfare systems and the prisons. And a specific request that we would put forward that the Special Rapporteur on the situation of the human rights and fundamental freedoms of Indigenous peoples visit Canada to specifically monitor the critical issue of violence against Indigenous women. We would add that to support the continued work on the UN treaty study and to call upon other UN bodies such as the Expert Mechanism and the Expert Advisory Committee to advance the work of treaties, to engage all proper UN agencies to initiate work on a true environmental protection instrument that is based on Indigenous laws, protocols, and knowledge and protects the Indigenous rights to water, land, and air. A focused effort and recommendation in the area of climate change, linking to outcomes from the recent World People's Conference on Climate Change and Mother Earth's Rights in Bolivia. Inclusion of water as future work and that a UN expert meeting focus on water, its sanctity, and its protection for future generations to be convened, and calling on states to report on the list of issues that were focused on by the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. A report card on the implementation of the second decade as a celebratory goal to end the decade. A world conference on Indigenous peoples with a focus on the declaration and on treaties. Recommendations of the report of the International Expert Group meeting on the role of the permanent forum be implemented. Three elements: creation of a procedure within the permanent forum to facilitate a constructive dialogue with states on the challenges, achievements, and future action that Indigenous issues require in each country under the declaration. Secondly, a mechanism be implemented to remind states of the binding characteristics of human rights. Thirdly, training programs for national parliamentarians, staff within national institutions such as human rights commissions and other agencies to result in transforming the declaration into national policies. Mr. Chair, in conclusion, I want to express deep appreciation to the Indigenous caucus that gathered. The voice and leadership of Indigenous peoples is critical globally to shift patterns of development towards ecologically sustainable models as reflected in Indigenous economies and cultures. Reconciliation involving full recognition of role and jurisdiction of Indigenous governments and establishing cooperative structures between all levels of state governments is required to reflect treaty, Aboriginal and title rights and remains fundamental to resolving socioeconomic challenges facing Indigenous peoples throughout North America. And as Chief Lyons has reminded those of us who are a little younger, it is up to us to continue to listen and learn from those who've been carrying this work out and to uphold our obligations that we've inherited by our ancestors to care for our people and our lands. This is our responsibility as Indigenous peoples, to continue to come together and strengthen one another. Mr. Chair, those are what we would like to offer up today. Let go, let go. Thank you very much.
Gracias, Chief Sean.
Thank you, Chief Sean. Having heard the panelists, I'd like to give the floor to Mr. Wilton Littlechild. You have the floor, sir.
Your Excellencies, expert members, respected elders, distinguished delegates, and ladies and gentlemen, I would like to begin by thanking the esteemed expert panel members for their excellent presentations on positive ways forward on this important discussion and focus on North America. I would like to welcome Ms. Kimberly Teehee, the Deputy Premier of Manitoba, the Honorable Eric Robinson, our National Chief, Sean Atleo, President Jeanette Corbier-Lavelle, and my co-commissioner, Marie Wilson, to the United Nations. As our expert member, Tanya Ganella-Frischner, just stated, and also by our national chief, I too want to thank the governments of Canada and the United States for their recent announcements, one that it would take steps to endorse the UN Declaration, and the other has decided to review its position and will be conducting a formal review of the Declaration and the United States' position on it. We state on behalf of our delegation that we want to work with you on this. Indeed, the North American Indigenous Caucus that took place on March 6th and 7th in the Treaty 6 territory of the Alexis Nakota Sioux Nation also expressed its readiness to work with Canada and the U.S. in this regard. Having said that, there are some concerns with both of your qualified positions. In a speech from the throne on March 3rd, the Governor General of Canada stated, and I quote, "Our government will take steps to endorse this aspirational document in a manner fully consistent with Canada's constitution and laws," end of quote. This was further referenced on April 20th of this week by the Government of Canada, when it announced that it will take steps to endorse the UN Declaration in a manner fully consistent with Canada's constitution and laws. Canada will take steps towards endorsing this aspirational document in a timely manner. Again, end of quote. It is clear that the United Nations Declaration is in fact consistent with the Constitution of Canada. Thus, a qualified endorsement where Canada does not accept all of the provisions of the Declaration or undermines or opposes certain aspects of the Declaration will be a step backwards for the advancement of the human rights of Indigenous peoples. Such a practice of qualified endorsements sets a bad precedent for future international declarations. We want to work in partnership with Canada and the U.S. to ensure that our human rights are upheld to the highest standard. Despite these concerns, we want to state clearly again that we welcome the very encouraging announcements of support for the UN Declaration, including those of the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon when he opened this ninth session. We wish to draw attention to two letters that have been submitted by Ken Hall and Tex Hall, former National Congress of American Indians president. First to President Clinton on February 24th in 2000, and recently on March 15th to President Obama on this matter. These letters are reflective of the collective positions of Indigenous peoples in North America. The Declaration provides a principled and normative legal framework for achieving justice and reconciliation between indigenous peoples and non-indigenous peoples. As the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has emphasized, and I quote, "The declaration is a visionary step towards addressing the human rights of indigenous peoples. It sets out a framework on which states can build or rebuild their relationships with indigenous peoples. The result of more than two decades of negotiations, it provides a momentous opportunity for states and indigenous peoples to strengthen their relationships, promote reconciliation, and ensure that the past is not repeated." The UN Declaration is the most comprehensive international human rights instrument addressing the rights of indigenous peoples. In many ways, it provides for harmonious and cooperative relations between indigenous peoples and states. This universal instrument is increasingly mainstreamed throughout the United Nations and within the inter-American and African human rights systems. Further, the declaration allows for full consideration of relevant international and domestic law. The UN Declaration elaborates international human rights standards for over 750 million indigenous peoples globally. They are among the most disadvantaged peoples, and their human rights are the most often trampled. This ongoing urgent situation provides a crucial opportunity for the United States and Canada to demonstrate its leadership on international and domestic human rights issues by endorsing the declaration, and if I may add, on a personal note, without qualifications. In addressing President Obama, Tex Hall stated, "We view very positively your address to the UN General Assembly on the 23rd of September 2009, where you affirmed that America will live its values and will lead by example. You added that democracy and human rights are essential to achieving each of the goals that you raised. You emphasize that America will always stand with those who stand up for their dignity and their rights, and that the United States stands ready to begin a new chapter of international cooperation. In the 2.5 years since the passage of the UN Declaration, none of the imagined negative consequences have materialized. The Declaration contains some of the most comprehensive balancing provisions that exist in any international human rights instrument. Every provision must be interpreted in accordance with the principle of justice, democracy, respect for human rights, equality, non-discrimination, good governance, and good faith. Mr. Chairman, these are principles that everyone in this grand hall values. All over the world, states, indigenous peoples, and organizations are already taking initiatives to use and implement the Declaration. In Canada, indigenous and human rights organizations are encouraged by the recent speech from the throne when it was announced that the Canadian government will take steps to endorse the Declaration. However, we share their concern that Canada appears to be unjustly qualifying its future endorsement by stating that it will take steps to endorse the Declaration in a manner fully consistent with Canada's constitution and laws. This would contradict the motion adopted by the Canadian House of Commons calling on Parliament and the government to fully implement the standards in the Declaration. To impose such limits would undermine the principle of universality of our human rights. It would also defeat the purpose of having international standards that encourage states to strengthen their human rights records. To require the provisions of the Declaration to be interpreted in accordance with the constitution and laws of each state could serve to legitimize any existing injustices and discrimination in domestic situations. The Declaration provides a crucial context and framework towards ensuring justice, as well as the dignity, security, and well-being of Indigenous peoples in the United States and throughout the world. As I indicated, this was all in a letter to President Obama. On another important matter, I would like to speak about the third Indigenous Leaders Summit of the Americas. The promotion of human rights in North America must be consistent with the important development taking place in the inter-American level at the Organization of American States. Specifically, the third Indigenous Leaders Summit of the Americas, the declaration and plan of action that came from that, set out a vision that must be implemented between now and the next summit in order to truly advance the human rights of Indigenous peoples throughout the Americas. We recently met with the Secretary General on March 15th to discuss implementation of the results of the third Indigenous Leaders Summit. One key recommendation is the need for the establishment of an OAS permanent forum for Indigenous peoples so that we can have the direct, full, and meaningful participation in decision-making on all matters that affect us. We thank the UN Permanent Forum for setting a model that has been exemplary in ensuring that the voices of Indigenous peoples are heard, and we welcome the Permanent Forum's support in this initiative. Yesterday, in a special event of the Secretary General to celebrate the International Year for the Rapprochement of Cultures, we stated that one of the ways to heal, revive, and strengthen cultures is by way of a celebration of life through sport and development, or self-determination through sport. Like the video you saw on the 2010 Olympics, since 1990, the North American Indigenous Games have been held every 3 years, involving Indigenous athletes and those that live our cultural ways and uphold our traditional games. This is only one example of such global celebrations of culture, and want to take this opportunity to discuss further the first World Indigenous Nations Games scheduled for August 2012 in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. All delegations, of course, through you, Mr. President, are invited and welcome to share their cultural knowledge and wealth with us and the world through sports. The WIN Sports Board of Directors and Sport Manitoba are present today during this ninth session. I dedicate this intervention to the memory of His Excellency, the IOC President, the International Olympic Committee President, Juan Antonio Samaranch, who was a tremendous supporter of the WIN Games. And in conclusion, yes, we have many challenges before us, but have also experienced some very positive developments in relation to the recognition of the human rights of Indigenous peoples. We need to celebrate our successes and continue the work in partnership to resolve outstanding human rights concerns. I believe the respected colleagues on the panel have today set us on a new path. As Ms. Kimberly Teehee stated, it's a new era. For me, it's a great day. Hi, hi, thank you.
Thank you, dear colleague. Very interesting statement. I would like now to invite my colleagues of the forum to make comments about this discussion, of the this dialogue about North America, if they wish. My colleague, Mick, you have the floor.
Mr. Vice Chairman, might I also express my appreciation to all the members of the panel for their contributions to this discussion. In spite of my accent, I'm not from North America. But I wanted to intervene to support something our brother Wilton Littlechild mentioned, as I'm the only member on the forum who has sport in his portfolio. I'd just like to tell us a bit more about the vision of the World Indigenous Nations Games and its first articulation in a resolution that was presented on behalf of the Indian Sports Olympic Organisation to the World Council of Indigenous Peoples way back in August in 1977 in a meeting in Kiruna in Sweden. Dr. Littlechild at that time. He's regarded as the founder and the international ambassador for these games. And it's from that vision that the idea of forming an international sports body was necessary, and thus the birth of WIN Sports, which was formerly known as the Indian Sports Olympics. It's an incorporated body federally in Canada. It's a not-for-profit organisation, and it has headquarters in Alberta. And it has a mandate from international sport and political organisations to plan, organise and conduct the WIN Games. And WIN Sports Incorporated Board of Directors is a group of uniquely experienced and highly qualified Indigenous individuals from around the world who serve together with an equally high-profile international advisory council, and I'm pleased to be associated with that. WIN is supported by dignitaries and Olympians worldwide and recognised by the former president of the International Olympic Committee that our brother Willie has just paid tribute to. In 2008, it was what was once only a dream finally became a reality with the help and support of the Deputy Premier of the Government of Manitoba that Willie's already referred to. And the City of Winnipeg was awarded the inaugural WIN Games for August 2012. The World Indigenous Games is a worldwide event that celebrates contemporary sports events, traditional Indigenous games, and cultures of the world's almost 400 million Indigenous peoples. The World's Indigenous Nations Games is a games of excellence, and the best of the best of the world's Indigenous peoples will be showcased in this international event. And athletes in contemporary sports will be identified through a national qualification process, and along with team sports will have an age limit of under 21 years. Regions will be encouraged to send both male and female athletes, teams and coaches. And the WIN Games, it's intended that they'll have 3,500 participants representing seven global regions: Asia Pacific, Australia, New Zealand region, the Arctic Circle polar region, the African region, the European region, and the group of Latin American countries region, the United States of America region and Canada region. And the Wynn Games will provide Indigenous peoples with an opportunity to present to the world their unique centuries-old traditional games and cultures. And the Wynn Games will create the opportunity to increase international solidarity and cooperation and coordination. The 2012 Wynn Games will coincide with the United Nations International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, celebrated each year on August 8th. And during the second, it will occur during the second International Decade of the World's Indigenous Peoples, which commenced in January 1. So I'd call on states and Indigenous peoples and other of our friends and supporters to get behind the Wynn Games and help us enjoy our right to sport. Thank you.
Shukran, les amis.
I thank my colleague, and I would like to give the floor to the representatives of governments if they wish to do so. You have the floor. Canada? You have the floor, please.
My name is Naurlok Nakhok, and I'm from Nunavut, Canada. The government of Nunavut has read with great interest the report of the International Expert Group meeting this past January. The Inuit of the Eastern Arctic signed the Nunavut Land Claim Agreement with the Government of Canada in 1993. At that time, we became partners in the holistic mode of development for which the expert group has advocated. 85% of the people living in Nunavut are Inuit. This demographic provides a unique opportunity to fulfill Article 32 of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. If we continue to give status and respect to our culture and language, we can then direct the development of our lands and resources in a sustainable and sustaining way. Our ongoing goal of fully participating as Inuit in the modern economy drives our government. We are in pursuit of development that amounts to more than extracting resources and collecting profits. As we cultivate and harvest the natural resources in this territory, we also promote the cultural, ecological, and economic integrity of Inuit. If we're to achieve equitable outcomes for Inuit in the course of development, we must concurrently support the right to high quality, culturally relevant education, passing on our Inuit knowledge, values, and language to our children is essential to our development as humans and is vital to our sense of dignity. Mr. Chair, this is precisely what Article 13 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the right to education, guarantees. If we're to honestly integrate our Inuit worldview into the process of development, we must actively support the protection and revitalization of the Inuit language. Our language is not just a collection of words. Our language is a priceless documentation system of our Arctic environment and of the lessons the Inuit have learned about how to live well within it. Importantly, Mr. Chair, in 2008, the Legislative Assembly of Nunavut enacted the Education Act and the Inuit Language Protection Act. Together, these statutes provide Inuit children the right to receive an education that will prepare them to enter adult life as global citizens. This legislation promises graduates that they will possess a rich knowledge of the Inuit language. It promises that they will be able to fully participate in the development of their communities. At its base, the legislation promises substantive equality in long-term development. Inuit language programs and services and education require adequate and sustained funding. The level must be sufficient to fully integrate the Inuit strengths, perspectives, and vision on equal footing into the development process. Without these supports, Inuit will be forced to choose to either assimilate or remain excluded from the modern economy, the development benefits accruing now to others. Nunavut urges the Permanent Forum to continue its work in advocating for states to provide sufficient funding for the protection, promotion, and revitalization of Indigenous languages and culturally relevant education. Thank you very much.
Merci, Madame la représentante du.
Thank you, Madam the Representative of the Government of Canada, for your statement. I'd like to give the floor now to Mr. Eric Robinson, the Minister from the Province of Manitoba.
Monsieur Eric Robinson.
Eric Robinson, you have the floor.
Merci, Monsieur le Président.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, friends.
Permanent Forum on the Indigenous Issues and other guests and representatives of Indigenous peoples, member states of the United Nations and guests from nations from across Mother Earth, welcome to our home. Turtle Island, my people's name for what is now called North America. I was especially inspired by the inspiring words given by Chief Warren Lyons, National Chief Atleo, Kimberly Teehee. Thank you very much for bringing some hope and inspiration to our people. My name is Gaginikoni Piwaniogamau, and the chair has referenced me as Eric Robinson. That is my English name. I am a member of the Cree Nation in northern Manitoba, and I greet you as a proud Indigenous person. It is thanks to the efforts of people like the late George Manuel and Dr. Willie Littlechild that I also greet you as a Deputy Premier of a Canadian province and as a member of a cabinet, a Minister of the Crown in the province of Manitoba, Minister of Sport, and Minister of Aboriginal and Northern Affairs. These people's efforts have ensured that our people, Indigenous peoples, can work anywhere and in a world-class way. I commend all of you for being at this forum on Indigenous issues. And our people, and I need not tell anybody in this room, have endured many attempts of forced assimilation. In my case, it was through de-Indianizing. At the age of 5, I was taken away from my family to a residential school whose aim was to take the Indian out of the child and to force a foreign language on me. I have learned that when a language is taken from a people, it is a major step in the loss of a culture. But as you can see, it is an unexpected honor to speak my language today in the Hall of the United Nations, a body whose goal is peace and understanding for all nations, great or small. Our people's struggles with colonization and rapid social change have left us with scarred bodies and bruised spirits. The forced adoption of our children away from their families to other communities, provinces, and in some cases to other countries was a blatant attack on the core of our identity and future. In the province of Manitoba, where I come from, we've experienced what we call a 60 scoop. Our own government statistics show more than 3,000 of our children were adopted out, or we might as well say stolen, from our embrace and sent to foreign cultures. I have witnessed the effects of sexual abuse against children perpetrated by people working for governments and churches. It stopped boys like me from growing into decent men. Instead, many of us became alcoholics, drug addicts, and abusers. There have been horrifying instances of forced sterilization of our sisters and a forced abortion of their children, a little spoken of reality that stripped away the ability of those women to be mothers. Other marginalizations have led to the Canadian tragedy of missing and murdered Aboriginal women. Our country has recorded nearly 600 cases in the last 40 years. And I commend the Canadian government for recently taking the leadership to make this one of their priorities and for committing to work with our provinces, territories, and Aboriginal people in seeking solutions. The grim legacy of colonialism is etched in the faces of our elders, alive in the eyes of our leaders, and a burden now carried by our children, but a spirit remains that will not be snuffed out. We are battling alcoholism, drug and solvent abuse, family dysfunction, homophobia, incest, suicides, and gangs. Indigenous peoples, on average, die younger and suffer a greater occurrence of preventable diseases like tuberculosis and diabetes, and are less educated and more likely to be incarcerated than our non-Indigenous brothers and sisters. This, of course, is no coincidence. Rather, it is the devastating result of centuries of failed social experiments. I am here today to talk about a task of putting our lives back together. A great leader of the Coast Salish people in British Columbia, Chief Dan George, once said, "O God, like the thunderbird of old, I shall rise again out of the sea. I shall grab the instruments of the white man's success, his education, his skills. And with these new tools, I shall build my race into the proudest segment of your society. I shall see our young braves and our chiefs sitting in the houses of law and government, ruling and being ruled by the knowledge and the freedom of our great land. So shall we shatter the barriers of our isolation. So shall the next 100 years be the greatest and proudest in the proud history of our tribes and nations." He spoke those words more than 40 years ago, and it was with great pride this year that I watched his grandson, Chief Justin George of the Tsleil-Waututh First Nation, welcomed the word as a head of state and as a member of the four host First Nations at the 2010 Winter Olympic Games in Vancouver, British Columbia. It is the first time that the International Olympic Committee has recognized Indigenous nations as equal partners. Governments of the world are beginning to see the value of working with our people. They are learning from experience that dictating to us doesn't work. I am encouraged that this week New Zealand changed its position on the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, and the United States has announced a new review of its position. And I'd like to congratulate President Obama and Prime Minister Key. The province of Manitoba was also pleased to hear about the Government of Canada taking steps to endorse the declaration. And I'm hopeful that they will partner with the province of Manitoba to make Winnipeg the home of the first ever gathering of the World Indigenous Nations Games in 2012. These games are an event by Indigenous people, the first time in our history where we can put our hearts and hands together with pride and celebrate our cultures and identities. And I want to take this time to acknowledge the vision and leadership of Dr. Willie Littlechild, who has been working toward this goal for more than 30 years. He and I believe that sport is a powerful unifying force. It can awaken a powerful force inside of us, all of us, and force us to focus in a positive way for ourselves and for our communities. We saw it at work the first time around in residential schools, where it provided us an opportunity to escape from the cruelty of the system. Today it is at work in some of Canada's poorest communities, in northern Canadian communities like Shamattawa. Kids can find the joy of being kids by playing sports. It is often their only reprieve from their daily reality of family dysfunction, overcrowded homes, and hunger. The government of Manitoba has committed $3.5 million to make the World Indigenous Nations Games a reality. and we are working hard to bring other partners on board. I'd like to encourage you to support us in this endeavor. It is not the first time that our government has worked with Aboriginal peoples to celebrate Indigenous culture and identity. In 2002, we hosted the North American Indigenous Games, bringing thousands of young people together in a spirit of friendly competition. In many Indigenous cultures, the youth and the elders are the most sacred elements of society, and our youth are the fastest growing segment of any demographic group. The vision of the World Indigenous Nations Games is to provide our youth with a legacy and a future. On behalf of the World Indigenous Nations Sports Board and the Government of Manitoba, I take this opportunity to invite you to share in this celebration of sport, culture, and of life. Join us in 2012 at the center of North America in Manitoba, or as my people call it, Montuapi, where the spirit sits. Egusane, hi hi, merci bien. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup.
Thank you very much. I would now like to give the floor to
Parliament, Ms. Juanita Castana. Are you in the room?
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for giving me the floor. Thank you. To the members of the forum for the very interesting contributions that I had the opportunity to hear. And I would like to give our comments and to focus on two examples of UNEP's work in the North American region. The first deals with the food security in northern Canada. Canada is internationally recognized and is as an economically wealthy and progressive country. But still, many Canadians, especially those who face poverty, and for those who live in very isolated communities where access and the high cost of living is a daily reality, they still face hunger. Food security is a multifaceted issue. It is affected not only by obvious influences such as climate and weather, but also by oil and commodity prices, trade and social policies, global politics, and population growth, to name just a few. It is generally accepted that the term food security means, in simple terms, access to nutritious food. The health and well-being of Northerners, and especially of Arctic Indigenous peoples, are directly linked to food security, and in particular, their relationship to customary country food, which encompasses community sharing, cultural continuity, and intergenerational communication. The Arctic, being on the front lines of climate change, will be forced to address food security sooner than other regions of Canada and many other areas in the world. How Alaska, North Canada, and the rest of the Arctic responds to this crisis may well provide valuable directions to others. By participating in programs such as Many Strong Voices, the Arctic can work together with other vulnerable or remote communities to find solutions to the food security challenge. The Government of Canada, following on the recommendations of the Arctic Council workshop on vulnerability and adaptation to climate change in the Arctic, commissioned UNEP's Grid Center in Arendal, Norway, to prepare a report on the impacts of climate change in the Canadian Arctic. The paper, Assessing the Impacts of Climate Change on Food Security in the Canadian Arctic, published last year, highlights the myriad of influencing factors, examines the impacts of climate change on food security in the Canadian Arctic, and how it compares to other global regions, and consider options for maintaining food security in the region. Issues addressed in the paper will provide the basis for a larger project on the impacts of climate change on food security in the circumpolar Arctic and small island development states, another region threatened by climate change. Now UNEP is working jointly with UNESCO and other partners on developing a food security project based on a recommendation from last year's Permanent Forum
call sustainable development of the Arctic in the face of global climate change, scientific, social, cultural, and educational challenges. The second example is the photography project entitled Portraits of Resilience. The project illustrates the ethical dimension of the climate change discussion through the words and photographs of high school students in Arctic communities in Shishmaref, Alaska, and Pangnirtung, Nunavut. It is important that the world is able to see not only the effects of climate change, but the efforts people are making to both combat and adapt to it. The goal of this project is to give young people a voice and to put a youthful human face on climate change in the Arctic. Throughout 2009, students have been trained in writing essays, taking photographs, and they have worked hard to bring their personal stories and faces and show their communities to the outside world. The project was first exhibited in the Danish National Museum during the December 2009 COP15 climate change negotiation in Copenhagen. It has also been displayed in Vancouver at Canada's Northern House during the Winter Olympics earlier this year and in Oslo at the Norwegian Museum of Cultural History. Both the Portraits of Resilience Photography Project and the Food Security Project are part of the Many Strong Voices program. That program was created in 2005 to bring together indigenous peoples, community organizations, policymakers, NGOs, and researchers from the Arctic and small island development states. One of its key goals is to make sure the voices of people in these vulnerable regions are heard in the United Nations Framework on Climate Change Negotiations, UNFCCC. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Juanita, for your statement. And next speaker on my list is Debra Harding, North American Caucus. Kindly limit your statement on 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nu Debra Harry Minaniat, Nu Kuiwipa. I'm honored to give this statement on behalf of the North American Indigenous Peoples Caucus, which met in a preparatory meeting in March 2010. And the full report of our caucus meeting is reflected in the permanent forum documents. This statement reflects the outcomes of our deliberations. The North American Indigenous Caucus welcomes this opportunity to engage with the United States and Canada on key issues of concern to Indigenous peoples in the region. We encourage the Permanent Forum to continue to provide this type of dialogue opportunity between Indigenous peoples and states in the future. With regard to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, delegates expressed concern that the two nation states in our region, namely the U.S. and Canada, voted against the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and to date have not yet endorsed the declaration unconditionally. Delegates welcomed the announcement by the Government of Canada in the throne speech of March 3, 2010, toward overcoming Canada's refusal to endorse the declaration, but expressed concern about the government's reference to qualified recognition and mischaracterization of the declaration as an aspirational document, and the conditional endorsement of the declaration in a manner consistent with the Canadian Constitution and laws rather than vice versa. Delegates also noted that the United States is currently reviewing its position on the declaration, while the U.S. and Canada have signaled a possible change in their position regarding the declaration. The North American Caucus is concerned that the states are attempting to place a domestic interpretation on the articles of the Declaration. Our recommendation is that the United States and Canada give their unconditional and unqualified endorsement of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and follow up with steps to ensure that their laws and policies are made consistent with the Declaration. Delegates expressed their readiness to work with Canada and the United States in that regard. On the topic of land rights, delegates stressed the need for state governments to reverse their laws and policies that are based on the colonial doctrine of discovery. In the Canadian context, in areas where no treaties have been signed, this refers to the doctrine of terra nullius and the failure to recognize the inherent jurisdiction and land rights of Indigenous peoples over their traditional territories. Canada's current land rights policy, the Comprehensive Claims Policy, continues to aim at the extinguishment of Aboriginal title within the context of the doctrine of discovery framework, rather than implementing an approach based on recognition and coexistence. The legal basis for Canada and the U.S. interactions with Indigenous peoples and nations with regard to lands, territories, and issues of sovereignty lead directly back to Johnson v. McIntosh and the doctrine of discovery. There is now ample evidence that the Johnson v. McIntosh case is based on fraud. Given the evidence of fraud and given the use of Christian religious categories, namely Christian people and natives who are heathens, as the basis of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in that case, we ask, how can Johnson v. McIntosh and the doctrine of discovery be treated by Canada and the U.S. as a valid foundational aspect of their legal systems? With regard to treaties, one of the major initiatives of the U.N. was to have a study on treaties by Dr. Miguel Alfonso Martinez. The delegates noted that his recommendations and conclusions are very important and need follow-up. Delegates also welcomed and supported in its entirety the conclusions and recommendations of the United Nations' first and second expert seminars on treaties and agreements. We have a number of recommendations that are reflected in our written statement, and I will make these available to the Secretariat. However, I believe it's very important to address one critical concern. It has been mentioned several times in these most recent days that Indigenous peoples want equal access to the American dream. I would like to conclude this one segment of our statement, Mr. Chair, if I may. We must remind you that the American dream comes at the cost of the destruction of Mother Earth to the detriment of Indigenous nations and peoples. In terms of languages, cultures, sacred sites and places, and all of the socioeconomic indicators mentioned today by the representative of the U.S., instead, we are citizens of our own respective nations, and consistent with Article 3 of the Declaration, we seek to exercise our right of self-determination and ensure the well-being of future generations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Madam Deborah Harin. I would like to call Argelia Munoz, Youth Caucus, Global Caucus.
Distinguished elders, honorable chair, esteemed members of the forum, brothers and sisters of the world, we thank you for this opportunity to address the 9th session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. We offer this with humility and respect for those who came before us. We reflect on the teachings of the youth who have previously attended this forum. Further, we acknowledge the intention to represent our perspectives of our region, North America. Honorable chair, there are two states that have yet to endorse the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We sincerely urge Canada and the United States to join the world community by endorsing the Declaration without reservations or qualifications. We hope the recent signing of the Memorandum of Understanding between Canada and the United States will help streamline this process and it will not be lost in review. We also recommend the permanent forum develop with Indigenous peoples strategies to hold governments accountable for the implementation of the declaration. Recommendations. 1. Call for the permanent forum to expand their memberships by adding a position to be filled by Indigenous youth, selected by Indigenous youth to represent Indigenous children and youth of the world by the next session of the forum in 2011. The Indigenous youth advanced this recommendation in the third session, and we ask the forum to carry this action this year. 2, for the permanent forum to work closely with UN agencies, including UNICEF, to secure funds that will ensure full participation of Indigenous youth at the forum. 3, we highly recommend an intergenerational youth preparatory meeting where youth would set the agenda items and train and mentorship will provide for Indigenous leadership experience to the process and supported by UN agencies such as UNICEF and UNDP that will allow Indigenous youth the capacity to address the challenges in order to give full recommendations related but not limited to language and traditional knowledge development and implementation, lack of culturally initiated employment, access to clean water for health and spirituality, high suicide youth suicide rates, incarceration and crime, right to self-determination, treaty rights, free, prior, and informed consent, forced displacement, violence, environmental racism and species extinction, desecration of sacred sites, the decriminalization of traditional medicine, threats to food sovereignty, as well as addressing health issues through avenues of traditional knowledge such as drug use, HIV, AIDS, cancer, and mental health and sexual and health rights. 4. Reinforce the recommendation by the Indigenous Youth Caucus in Agenda Item 3, Human Rights. We urge the forum to create measures that will help preserve culture in times of natural disasters and forced relocation. 5. We fully support a comprehensive study on the doctrine of discovery that has served as the foundation for the violations of human rights of Indigenous people, and also a comprehensive study on the treaty rights and implementation in the United States and Canada. 5. Acknowledging that Mexico is in the Latin American region of the permanent forum, however, regional placement with the economic and political realities in North America has encouraged us to include this in the statement. Racial profiling, exploitation of labor, physical, sexual, and mental abuse endured by children and youth by the hands of vigilante groups and Ordinance SB 1070, which outsources migrant regulations from federal jurisdiction to local law enforcement that are only a few avenues which perpetuate terror on Indigenous peoples. We recommend that the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous People do a full investigation on the abuse of
por
Indigenous
favor,
children and youth.
Un momento, por ponencia. Favor.
Mexican border. The United States wants an equal shot to pursue the American dream. We thank you, but we want an equal shot to pursue our dream, the Indigenous people's dream. We appreciate your time to address these issues and hope that this heartfelt request is fully taken into consideration. Tasso Kamatli.
La próxima oradora.
The next speaker on our list is Ms. Shalem McMohan. That's Sheila McMahon of the National Association of Friendship Centers. Ms. McMahon, you have the floor.
Tiene la palabra.
You have the floor.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would like to bring greetings on behalf of the National Association of Friendship Centers to you and to all of those wonderful people that are in assembly today, and to acknowledge that this is the 40th anniversary of Earth Day. In our presentation, we have agreed to forward our recommendations to the Secretariat that we want to ensure that in continuing agendas of the forum that there will be urban Aboriginal people's agenda, that we would continue to work with our partners in Canada, ensuring that they work to endorse the urban or the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People without qualification, that we would like to ensure that the urbanization for Indigenous peoples will continue to be served in the work that we do, and that we continue to endorse and support the young people's efforts in their attempts to bring their agendas and their support to this assembly. That we want to ensure that we will continue to do our responsibilities in bringing forward our recommendations for the improvement of urban Aboriginal Indigenous issues, and to support all of our brothers and sisters in their endeavors as they have so outlined today in their presentations. I want to say miigwech for the opportunity.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. Mr. Armin McKenzie of the Innu Nation.
Señor McKenzie, por favor.
Mr. McKenzie, please.
I didn't speak. I would have time to speak here, but nevertheless, a Canadian piece of legislation that, if passed, would mandate Canadian extractive companies to live up to international human rights norm when they operate overseas is being massively opposed by Canadian mining industry lobbyists and industry associations. The groundbreaking bill is also actively opposed by the Government of Canada. But the bill is strongly supported by Canadian labor unions, by a majority of members of parliament, by a broad cross-section of civil society groups, and by human rights groups. Bill C-300, the Corporate Accountability of Mining, Oil, and Gas Corporations in Developing Countries Act, proposes that Canadian extractive companies operating in developing countries adhere to environmental and human rights standards. Bill C-300 provides for the development of mandatory standards for Canadian extractive companies that shall incorporate human rights provision that ensure corporations operate in a manner that is consistent with international human rights standards. Bill C-300 would apply only to those Canadian extractive companies that rely on taxpayers-funded financial or political support, for example, through Canadian embassies. If complaints are brought against these companies, they would be subject to investigation by the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Minister of International Trade. Companies found to be in violation of the proposed standards would lose their eligibility for some government service until they return to compliance. Recent testimony on Bill C-300 before the Canadian Parliamentary Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Development provides evidence that Canadian mining companies that are not living up to high standards in their operations are causing very serious environmental damage and abusing the human rights of neighboring communities in Latin America, Africa, and the Asia-Pacific region. The testimony shows that, in particular, Indigenous peoples are suffering the brunt of the activities of irresponsible Canadian mining companies operating overseas. We therefore urge the Canadian government to support the passage of Bill C-300, as it is consistent with the human rights obligations that Canada has endorsed and is also consistent with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was adopted by the UN General Assembly in 2007. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you. The next speaker on our list is Chief Howard Thompson of the American Indian Law Alliance. Chief Howard, you have the floor.
At this time, I'd like to make an intervention on U.S.-Canadian border issues presented by the Haudenosaunee to the 9th session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. I'm going to start by making recommendations, and then I'll explain why we're making these recommendations. We call on the Permanent Forum to recommend that Canada and the U.S. initiate a process to directly dialogue with the Mohawk Nation and the Haudenosaunee Confederacy to resolve grave situation. Recommendation 2, we call for Permanent Forum use its good offices to find a peaceful resolution to the Canadian-U.S. border issue involving the Mohawk Nation and to send UN observers to monitor the situation of human rights abuses and further escalation of the crisis. Recommendation 3, we call upon the Permanent Forum to recommend the United States and Canada invite a special rapporteur, James Anaya, to visit the Mohawk Nation on a fact-finding mission to assess the border situation. The reason for this recommendation: on July 1, 2009, the CBSA, Canadian Border Service Agency, made a unilateral decision to arm the port of Akwesasne. The decision was made without forewarning or consultation, and certainly without free, prior, and informed consent of the Mohawk people who live in Akwesasne. It came as a shock to the Mohawk people. Predictably, the Mohawk community and leadership responded angrily because the weapons threatened the peaceful coexistence engaged by the citizens of Canada, the United States, and the Mohawk Nation. The strong reaction by the Mohawk community to the idea and reality of weapons on Mohawk territory caused CBSA to move the port of entry to Cornwall, Ontario. This in turn escalated the turmoil already visited on the Mohawk community on both sides of the imposed border by in keeping with the framework of dominance, forcing Mohawk community members to report to two separate ports of entry when traveling over the border. It is important to note that during the time, in keeping with the framework of dominance, the CBSA made no attempts to communicate with the besieged Mohawk community of Akwesasne. The next and most provocative action taken by CBSA, again in keeping with the framework of dominance, was to arbitrarily impound the cars of the Mohawk people within the Mohawk territory. They're impeding the Mohawk people from reaching their homelands before and after everyday activities of attending school, traveling to places of employment, going to medical appointments, to pick up their prescriptions and medications, obtaining food and water supplies, as well as preventing the movement of chronic care vehicles. In keeping with the framework of dominance, the CBSA imposed a requirement.
Terminar con su participación.
Could you please conclude your statement?
I'd like to thank you for your time and patience on this. Thank you.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you. The next speaker on our list is Mr. Wes George of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations Teton Sioux Council. Mr. George, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Kakisiwa, Ochapways, and Pabikisis Cree Nations are parties to the International Treaty No. 4, agreed to September 15, 1874. Our treaties are made and brought under protection of our constitutions, and our constitutions predate European contact, colonization, trade, and settlement by millennia. Ours are not constitutions rooted in another country, such as the Constitution of Canada is rooted in English sovereignty and our treaties. Our treaties are the highest law of the land for Her Majesty, and it is only by our treaties that the Queen is permitted by us to be present here in our lands. Canada, as a successor nation to the treaties, has imposed its internal law to dictate and interpret the treaties through their transplanted law system, thus violating international law and avoiding international standards and instruments to achieve their domestic agenda of capturing our international status treaties under Canadian law. This was never the intended relationship, and this is the issue we bring forth to the Permanent Forum's attention. The UN study on treaties made these observations and concluded that our treaties, in fact and practice, retain international status, character, and responsibility, and that the 1969 Vienna Convention on Law of Treaties applies. Further, the Special Rapporteur Martinez had recommended that 3 treaty expert seminars be held, and these remain outstanding unfinished business. we recommend that the two UN treaty seminars held in 2003 and 2006 be enforced and fully implemented, and to carry out the third seminar as mandated by the UN Economic and Social Council. We also recommend that a world conference on indigenous peoples be organized and sponsored by the United Nations to mark the end of the second decade of the world's indigenous peoples. I now turn the mic over to my colleague Evelyn Patra.
Mr. Chairman, contrary to our treaties and contrary to the law of war, components of public international law, the governments of Canada engaged in tactics designed to terminate us through the Indian residential schools. Through targeting of non-combatants, our children, and contrary to laws governing justice and war, her governments are responsible for atrocities that have brought dishonor to Her Majesty and have tarnished the crown. We were corralled and kept behind fences and viewed as less than human, as beasts of the field, only to be freed and franchised upon being declared by the federal government, sufficiently civilized according to the Christian standard and doctrines, to be allowed to come beneath Her Majesty's Constitution, beneath her governments. This was completely unconstitutional and a failure to abide by the rule of law. The rule of law, as said, makes our government subject to our treaties the highest law that they must respect. The File Hills Indian Farm Colony was a one-of-a-kind experiment in Canada imposed on Pipixis. It was the Indian agent's grand social engineering scheme designed to solve the Indian problem and to ensure that the residential school graduates would not return to the teepee and to their old, and to the ways of their old people. It involved creating a farming colony composed of select Indian residential school graduates who are not Pipixi's band members but were given land allotments to this on this Indian reserve for their farming. In some cases, the residential school graduates did not have a choice about coming to this colony, and some are even part of arranged marriages devised by the local school principal and residential school
principal. Señora, ruego concluir con su participación.
If you could be so kind as to conclude.
Keteyak Old Ones are calling on the powers of advocacy for the plight of the Pipixis Keteyak and the people of the Pipixis Cree Nation, and they call upon the Special Rapporteur and the Permanent Forum to be advised and informed of the File Hills Indian Farm Colony on the Pipixis Cree Nation to investigate and provide enforceable recommendations to bring justice to this outstanding historical wrongdoing committed against our peoples.
Nuestro próximo orador.
The next speaker on our list is Mr. Kenneth Deere of the Indigenous World Association. Mr. Deere.
The Indigenous World Association would like to thank the Permanent Forum for giving us this opportunity to meet with Canada, United States, along with Indigenous participation. This is a very rare event, and we encourage and hope we can have this far more often, and also more participation by those people sitting in the gallery here. Lately, the Prime Minister of Canada went in front of the world press at a meeting at the G8 and told the whole world that Canada has, I quote, no history of colonialism, a pompous and arrogant statement which was totally inaccurate and insulting to colonized Indigenous peoples in Canada. The Prime Minister of Canada has no idea what it is like to be Indigenous, nor has he apologized for making such an incredulous statement. We welcome the announcement that Canada will eventually endorse the declaration and that the United States is reconsidering its position. These are positive signs. We hope that these announcements will result in more support for Indigenous peoples in international conferences and forums. For instance, Canada, U.S. and Canada boycotted the Durban Review Conference last year on the pretext that the conference was biased against Israel. If you read the Durban Declaration of 2001, you will not find any derogatory articles against Israel, but you will find one article that states, in part, the term Indigenous peoples does not imply any rights under international law. That is biased, discriminatory, in our opinion, racist against Indigenous peoples. Fortunately, Canada and the United States boycotted the Durban Review Conference, and as a result, a paragraph in the outcome document states that the conference welcomes the endorsement of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and that it should be used to combat racism against Indigenous peoples. This is an important paragraph for us, and we doubt if that we would have gotten such a paragraph had the United States and Canada attended the conference. We thank you for boycotting the conference, but not for the reasons that you stayed away. Perhaps if Canada and U.S. boycotted more UN meetings, we would get better paragraphs on the rights of Indigenous peoples. This is not only our opinion, but the opinion of many states. One final point, Mr. Chairman. We would like to comment on the description of indigenous peoples by governments in North America with terms like status Indians or federally recognized tribes. It is the Creator who put indigenous peoples in what is called North America. It is not for the states to decide who is indigenous and who is not. The Creator decided that for us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Vamos a dar ahora.
We're now going to hear the last speaker on our list, Chief Ghislain Picau of the Assembly of First Nations, Grand Council of the Crees of Quebec, and other Indigenous peoples. Chief, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hamadnan, Nariyajaji Prasnamadi Munan, Indigenous peoples and human rights and faith-based organizations welcome the announcement on March 3rd that the Canadian government is taking steps to endorse the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We urge the government to embrace this vital human rights instrument without qualifications. The Declaration provides a principled and normative framework for partnership and reconciliation between states and Indigenous peoples. Its adoption was heralded around the world by Indigenous peoples, states, human rights organizations, and the United Nations. Its provisions provide much-needed guidance to governments, state institutions, and society as a whole on how human rights laws and obligations can be best understood and applied to the distinct circumstances and the urgent needs of 370 million Indigenous peoples around the world. We are concerned, however, as to what is intended by the Government of Canada in stating that it will take steps to endorse the Declaration in a manner fully consistent with Canada's Constitution and laws. In opposing the Declaration, the government had claimed that there were unspecified and unsubstantiated incompatibilities between the Declaration and the Canadian Constitution. As affirmed in an open letter from more than 100 experts on constitutional and international law aspects relating to Aboriginal rights in Canada, there is no contradiction between the Canadian Constitution and the Declaration. Furthermore, human rights standards cannot merely condone or sustain the current practices and preferences of states, whether or not those practices and preferences are expressed in domestic law. To limit UN declarations in this way would defeat the purpose of having international standards, which are meant to inspire and guide, improve protection for human rights, not simply reinforce the status quo. To require the provisions of the declarations to be interpreted in accordance with the Constitution and laws of each state could serve to legitimize any existing injustices and discrimination in domestic situations. It would also undermine the principle of universality that applies to all human rights. In interpreting human rights and related state obligations, domestic courts may choose to consider declarations and other international instruments. Such dynamic interaction between domestic and international law is well established in Canada. The Declaration is a living instrument that is broadly supported and has universal application. It provides a crucial context and framework towards ensuring justice as well as the dignity, security, and well-being of Indigenous peoples worldwide. In my view, Ambassador Rice put it best. There can be no just and decent future for our nation that does not directly tackle the legacy of bitter discrimination and sorrow that the first Americans still live with. And America cannot be fully whole until its first inhabitants enjoy all the blessings of liberty, prosperity, and dignity. Let there be no doubt of our commitment, and we stand ready to be judged by the results. End of quote. We recommend to Canada the following: that the Government of Canada work in genuine partnership with Indigenous peoples for the unqualified endorsement and full implementation of the Declaration, and that such endorsement and implementation honor the spirit and intent of the Declaration consistent with Indigenous peoples' human rights. So, Mr. Tuckerman, no, thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you. As we come to the conclusion of our meeting, I'd like to thank the panelists who showed us the path to dialogue, as described by Chief Lyons. Dialogue over this long conflict resulting from colonization and our situation of exclusion, of poverty, colonization of our lands, and so forth. It's very good practice to have dialogue on equal footing between states and Indigenous peoples. And I think it's an example that we will be following in other sessions in the years to come. And I'd like to announce that in the 10th session of the Permanent Forum, we'll have a half-day of dialogue on the South American, Caribbean, and Latin American region. So this is very important to the governments of the region and to the Indigenous peoples. Before concluding, I'd like to give the floor to the Secretary for some important announcements.
Thank you, sir. I have two brief announcements. One, there will be a meeting of the Global Caucus on Monday, 26 April, at 8:30 a.m. in Conference Room 1. Also, the Interagency Support Group will meet with the chairs and co-chairs of the various Indigenous caucuses between 9 a.m. and 9:45 a.m. on Friday, 23rd April, in the DC2 building, East 44th Street. It's next to Millennium Plaza Hotel, on the 8th floor in the UNEP meeting room. Please be prompt. The Interagency Support Group member, her name is Rochelle, will be at the reception from 8:50 to 9 o'clock in the morning to sign the Indigenous chairs in and bring them up to the meeting room. Thank you very much. That's it. You
have it. Mañana bien.
Tomorrow, Friday, 23 April, the Permanent Forum will hold a dialogue with the Secretariat of the Convention on Biological Diversity. Our next meeting will take place at 10 a.m. in the General Assembly Hall. This meeting is adjourned.